system. So this, maybe I should highlight the words I'm talking about. That's a good idea. I like that. So people can see. That's good. Huh? Okay, so let's carry on a little bit, because we have only done one sentence of the sutta so far. just to remind you that faith, then, is the reason why we should practice Buddhism, yeah? We don't really practice Buddhism just because it is our tradition, or it is because how we grew up, or, I mean, that's also okay, but ideally we come from this idea of confidence, and it means that we should build up these qualities, and then we will be practicing in the right way, from the right motivation. This is what the Buddha is saying here. So, then you go forth from the lay life to homelessness, yeah? And because you have gone forth in faith, because you have the right attitude, yeah? Because you are following the teaching of the Buddha, you are appreciating how the Buddha is teaching things, because of that, when you come together, you talk about the teachings, yeah? This is why you come together in Buddhism, yeah? To talk about the teaching, especially on the monastic path. In lay life is a little bit different, but on the monastic path, you talk about the teachings. Why? Well, because everything else is really like a waste of time, yeah? You talk maybe a little bit about nice things in the world, you talk a little bit just to feel at ease and relaxed, but essentially everything is really about Dhamma. How can we be inspired? How can we understand these teachings better? So why should we talk about the Dhamma? And again, there's two reasons why we should talk about the Dhamma. One is to understand what the Dhamma is about, especially to understand what it is that we have to do. Yeah? So there is like the information aspect. This is how you are kind. This is how you avoid being immoral. This is how to think. This is how to direct the mind in the right way. These are the good intentions to have. Yeah? This is how you meditate. You don't watch the breath straight away. You relax first, then you watch the breath. Yeah? These kind of things. So this is the information side. And information side is important. But there is also the other side about the Buddhist teachings. And there is a nice passage in the Mahasunyata Sutta, the longer discourse on emptiness, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya 122, and where the Buddha says that you have heard enough teachings. Now the reason why you should listen to the teaching is not just to learn more about the Dhamma, but to feel inspired about these teachings. Yeah, this is also why we listen to the teachings. So when you come to a retreat like this, these are the two things you should look for. You should look for understanding better about what the teachings are about, but hopefully also to gain some inspiration in these teachings. Yeah, things that lift you up, because you understand that you are in the presence of something very powerful and very useful in your life. Yeah, so this is about listening to the Dhamma and understanding the Dhamma in the right way. And as you do that, that is when it becomes very useful for you now. So you sit together, you talk about the Dhamma, says the Buddha. And when you're sitting together, you should do one of two things: discuss the teachings or keep noble silence. Yeah, so if I suddenly go quiet, maybe it means that I've kind of had enough of teaching, now it's time for noble silence, so then we just sit quietly, see what happens. And it's kind of interesting. One of the things that you will notice in life is that people have a tendency to fill the silence. Yeah, if you are together with someone, everyone goes silent, soon enough someone will start talking. It's almost as if they feel uncomfortable, yeah, or too much quiet. Okay, better talk about something, yeah? This is a very common feeling among people in the world. But among Buddhists, there should be no problem with being silent together. Yeah, just sitting in silence is okay. Yeah? And one of the beautiful things I like about someone like Ajahn Brahm, very often I sit next to Ajahn Brahm in our monastery, and when I sit next to Ajahn Brahm, often he's just silent. Yeah, he doesn't say anything. Yeah? And when you're with someone who is naturally silent like Ajahn Brahm, it feels very comfortable to be silent. Yeah, you can relax in that silence. I'm sure that many of you are married, yeah, or whatever. And after many years of being married together, you feel at ease and you feel relaxed in the company of your husband and wife, yeah? Because you know each other well, you trust each other, you understand each other. You don't have to talk all the time anymore. Huh? And ideally, it should be a little bit like that with our fellow Buddhists. Yeah, because we know we can trust them. They are good people who won't take advantage of us. Sometimes we can just sit together in silence and enjoy the company of silence, knowing that this is a good way also to being together. Not have to talk all the time. And so this is something to keep in mind. Instead of filling the kind of the vacuum, filling the emptiness that seems to arise when we don't talk. Actually, that's not really a Buddhist way of doing things. No need to fill that hole. Instead, silence is golden, as the old English saying goes. You will notice here, this beautiful word noble arises again. In Buddhism, the idea of silence is noble. Noble is an elevated quality. It has a quality which is kind of above ordinary qualities in the world. So silence is something very, in Buddhism, it's very kind of a high kind of quality. It's like virtue. Yeah, it's like metta, it's like karuna, all of these kind of things. Silence is something that is very pregnant and the cause very often of insight, of understanding. It is when you are silent that understanding the world arises. It is in silence that you feel a sense of profundity and depth and meaning in your life. Silence has something about it which is far more meaningful than chatter, than talking, than always being engaged with things in the world. So remember simple things like that, which is very contrary to how most people think about silence. Most people don't really like silence. But if you like silence, it means you are a more profound person than most people in the world. Silence is powerful. Silence is pregnant with meaning. Silence is something that actually enhances our lives. So the Pali word for silence down here is tunhi bhava, being quiet. All right, so this is what the Buddha says. And then he carries on. He says, mendicants, there are these two searches. The noble search and the ignoble search. So the word search here is called pariyesana in Pali. It means like seeking. Yeah, you are seeking something. And the idea here is that all people in the world, we seek things. Yeah, I don't know if you ever consider yourself as a seeker, but one of the things that we all seek, because we all desire it, we all seek an end of problems in our life. We all seek more happiness in our lives, more contentment, more satisfaction, more meaning, all of these positive things. And if you look into your heart, you will realize this is true, right? If you look into your heart, you will see that everything that drives your life, that motivates you to do anything at all, from the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you go to bed at night, all the things that drive you are a search for this ending of suffering and an increase in happiness and contentment in your life. When you get up in the morning, maybe you have breakfast or something like that. Do you choose a breakfast that you like, or do you choose a breakfast that you don't like? You choose a breakfast that you like, I presume. Anyone who chooses a breakfast they don't like? No one, right? And if you choose a breakfast that you don't like, it means you are a masochist. A masochist, they like to not like, so still you like. Same problem. Same issue again. So everything in our lives is driven towards this goal of seeking some kind of contentment, some kind of happiness, some kind of meaning, some kind of purpose in our existence. So this is, we are all searching for something here. We're trying to find this thing which makes life really meaningful and purposeful. And it's right there in your heart. And all you have to do is look within yourself and feel that drive that always drives you towards something where you're going to find some kind of purpose and meaning. And the Buddha is saying here is that the way we approach this search can be divided into two different categories. Either it can be considered a noble search or it can be an ignoble search. And the ignoble search is like an ordinary search, is the search of ordinary people in the world. this is a search where you haven't really considered reality properly. You haven't really looked at things carefully. You haven't investigated things properly. All you do is you follow along what everyone else in the world does. Everyone else in the world says, if you do this, if you kind of go to school, you work really hard at university, then you kind of get married, you have 1.5 kids. What is the average now in Malaysia? I don't know what the average is. Whatever the average is, you have 1.5 kids, you have a nice car. What kind of car? Proton or whatever? No, what is it called? Whatever it is that you have this kind of apartment in KL, then you're going to be happy, right? Then things are going to work out, because this is what everyone else does. But actually the reality is, if you do what everyone else does, the guarantee is that you're not going to be happy, right? That's the guarantee. Because if you look at the vast majority of people in the world, the average person, are they really happy, the average person? Not really. They kind of muddle through life. They do this, they do that. They are reasonably okay, but they don't really find the meaning here. And very often when people come to the end of their life, if you follow and see what happens to them, they come to their deathbed, and very often they are kind of okay, but they haven't really discovered anything profound. They have just gone through things, and very often they wonder on the deathbed, what was this all about? I did all of these things. I did what everyone else said I should be doing, but actually it hasn't really given anything particularly, right? I'm still kind of haven't really gotten any wiser. Nothing has really happened in my life. So if you just follow what everyone else does, you're going to have the same results as everyone else. And these are results that are not all that interesting here. So I always say to people, be the black sheep. You want to be the black sheep? Please be the black sheep, because the white sheep, they all make the same mistake. Yeah, they follow along. The first sheep comes to the cliff, walks over the cliff. Everyone else also walks over the cliff. It is the black sheep that turns around, walks away from that cliff. So please don't be that white sheep. Instead, be the black sheep or the pink sheep. I recently heard about someone. This was apparently an artist in Iceland. Have you heard about Iceland? They're far away, very cold country, lots of ice, no trees. But apparently they have sheep. And there was this artist in Iceland who said she would paint all her sheep. She would paint them pink, right? And they're wondering, why do you paint them pink? Well, because these are different kind of sheep, yeah? So it was like not the black sheep, but the pink sheep, yeah? They're thinking for themselves. So maybe we should think of the pink sheep as Buddhist, or maybe the brown sheep, right, to kind of reflect the monastic robes, right? Taking a different way. Maybe black sheep is not so good. So the Buddha is like the brown sheep, yeah? He wearing the monastic robes, and he takes a different direction. And we should follow the Buddha. We also should be brown sheep, black sheep, pink sheep. Call it what you like, but don't be the white sheep. Actually, many of you are wearing beautiful white. I shouldn't say that, right? You are all the white sheep. It's very nice to see you all wearing white, by the way. I really like that. There's kind of something about that which is very pure and very beautiful. So I really appreciate that. So I should be careful what I say here. So you. But it is the noble search begins when we dare to think differently. Yeah. And this is the idea of the Buddhist idea of looking in the right place, understanding that real meaning in life, you have to actually walk a different path. That is where the noble search happens. So what is this noble search? And this is what the Buddha is going to talk about now. And he's going to talk about, of course, his own life before his awakening and how he was able to distinguish between the noble search and the ignoble search. And again, this beautiful idea of noble, which comes in here, which I think is very very significant. The Buddha is always very good at using kind of the right words to elevate the things that are important in life. So this is what he has to say. Oop, go away. So, what is the ignoble search? It is when someone who is themselves liable to be reborn seeks what is also liable to be reborn. Yeah? So when someone is liable to be reborn, you seek what is also liable to be reborn. Why is that a problem? Well, that is a problem because from a Buddhist point of view and from understanding the nature of the world, the way the world is, rebirth is problematic. Yeah? Why is rebirth problematic? Well, rebirth is problematic because we don't know where we're going to get reborn. We don't know how we're going to get reborn. We don't know how many times we're going to get reborn. And if you carry on getting reborn and doing the same thing again and again all the time, after a while you get fed up. It's like Groundhog Day, right? A million times doing the same thing. You had enough of doing the same thing. I sometimes think about my own life, and I have to admit I've had a very good life. I look back on what, you know, I've had good parents, good family, good education. My family was well off. I wasn't completely dumb when I grew up. Had a bit of intelligence. I had a couple of girlfriends when I was young before I became a monastic, right? Let's be clear about that. And so I basically done everything that anyone wants to do in this life. But if someone were to tell me you have to do everything one more time, or not one more, but 1,000 times again after this, no way I want to do it again. Absolutely no way. It isn't that interesting, and there's plenty of suffering on the way, plenty of heartache, plenty of problems, plenty of all kind of things. There's no way I would want to do it again. And I've had a really good life. What about the people who've had difficult lives? Yeah. And so this is the idea of rebirth. Once you start to understand what rebirth actually means, once you start to understand this idea, it actually is quite repulsive. And it's quite scary when you understand the idea of samsaric existence. So the idea of being reborn, this whole concept of rebirth, is a very, very important part of Buddhism. And I'm shocked sometimes when I hear people saying that rebirth doesn't really matter. I'm shocked when I say that rebirth is just some kind of ancient idea that has no relevance in our contemporary culture. It has a massive relevance in our contemporary culture. And it's something that we should take extremely seriously. And if you take out the idea of rebirth out of the Buddhist teachings, basically the Buddhist teachings collapse. They don't exist. They cannot exist without the idea of rebirth. This is what gives meaning to these things. So what the Buddha is saying here then, he's saying that if other things are subject to being reborn, and that is already a problem, I am seeking the same thing. Well, I'm just compounding the problem. I'm seeking these other things that already have a problem, then I follow along in the same way. I'm actually making things worse. So there's no point in seeking things that are subject to suffering, subject to problems, because actually this is obviously just compounding and carrying on with the problem as it actually is. So this is what is going on here. Now, I want to just discuss very briefly this translation here of rebirth, yeah, because the Pali word is the word over here. You can see the word jati dhammo, and the word jati is the word that is translated as rebirth. Dhamma is translated as liable. Yeah, liable is dhamma, jati is rebirth. And perhaps you think that jati means birth, it doesn't mean rebirth. So why does Bhantasujata translate it as rebirth in this particular case? And the answer is that, remember, we are here in a particular culture in ancient India. And in the ancient Indian culture, if you are born, it means you are also reborn. Right? There is no real distinction between birth and rebirth. Every time someone is born is also an instance of rebirth. So when you teach the ancient Indian audience, you teach them about birth, what they will hear when you hear the word birth, they will hear rebirth. And because they hear rebirth, but we don't hear that, if you want to bring that out in translation, you have to translate as rebirth. Otherwise, you're losing some of the meaning that the original audience would have heard. This, to me, is a right way of translating. You have to translate in a way whereby you carry over the meaning that the original audience would have heard. Yeah. So jati, meaning rebirth here, is actually a correct way of translating this. Now, so that is the first point that I just want to make about the idea of the word jati. Now, the other thing which is very interesting here, right? The Buddha is talking about rebirth as if he considers it a reality, yeah, as if he considers it something that is true. But he's not yet enlightened at this point. So how can the Buddha have known at this point that there was such a thing as rebirth? Yeah, it seems to be an assumption that he's making, right? He's not enlightened yet. He hasn't had his profound insights into reality. So is he just taking on the ideas of the Indian culture? Or is he having insight into the idea of rebirth? Now, this is a very important point. It's a very important point because very often when people dismiss the idea of rebirth, what they do is that they argue that the Buddha would just take on board the ideas of the contemporary culture, right? And then those people who disagree with that, they will say, well, the Buddha actually investigated and he discovered the nature of rebirth on his night of awakening. So there's two different ideas. They're contrasting with each other. On the one hand, the idea that the Buddha took it on from the culture. On the other hand, the idea that he understood it through his own insight. So which one of these is correct? And they are both correct, right? And this is what is fascinating here. They're both correct because what we are seeing here, we're seeing actually the idea of the Buddha basically assuming that the idea of rebirth is true. He is not the Buddha yet. He's still the Buddha to be. He's trying to understand the nature of reality, but he hasn't yet understood it. And in the meantime, he has to make certain assumptions. It's the same with all of us, right? If I ask you, do you believe in rebirth? You probably say yes. If you say no, that's okay. That's fine. But many of you will say yes because you've been Buddhist for a long time. But you also know that it is just a belief. You don't know it yet. In the meantime, it is just a belief until you come to know these things. And so we all have to have a starting point. We have to make certain assumptions. And the assumption of the Buddha, because it doesn't yet know, is that there is rebirth. It is a part of the understanding of that society in ancient India that there is rebirth. And Buddha takes that thing on board. But, and this is the critical thing here, even though the Buddha takes it on board temporarily as a kind of preliminary understanding of the world, he also understands, I don't know this for sure. I have to investigate it down the line. And because he knows that, on his night, before his final awakening, he then does recall his past lives. He goes into that kind of samadhi which is required to remember his past lives, and then he verifies it for himself that there is such a thing as rebirth. Yeah? So both sides of the equation are required. There's always a requirement of confidence to begin with, and then there is a requirement of verification down the track. Yeah? And it's the same thing with us in the same way. The way we should proceed with the Dhamma, which is start out with a degree of confidence and faith in these teachings. If the Buddha said there's rebirth, okay, I should take it seriously, right? It must be very important. But you also know that this is not really knowledge. This is not really full understanding on your path. So down the track, we hope to verify this through the way we think about this and through the way we have investigated these teachings and ultimately have insight into them. So this gives a more nuanced idea of the idea of how the Buddha looked at the world. It is not just either he took on board the existing ideas or he had insight. Actually, it's a bit of both. And that is really what is happening here. So this is the ignoble search, right? When you are liable to be reborn and you seek other things that are liable to be reborn. Instead of solving the problem that is at hand, you compound the problem and make it worse. So. And then it goes on. Here he says, themselves liable to grow old, to fall sick, to die, to sorrow, to become corrupted, they seek what is also liable to these things. So far we only had a look at rebirth. Here we have all of these other kind of downsides of existence, that you have to become old. Yeah, you have to become sick. I'm going to discuss all of these things a little bit later on. you have to die. Yeah, everything ends in death. All the happiness that you had in life will have to end in death. You have to be separated from everything. Yeah. And then we have this couple of other things here that are added, that are kind of particular to this particular sutta. Sorrow. Yeah, sorrow is part of human existence. If you have been reborn, you're going to have sorrow. You're going to have grief. This is just what life is like. And then you have this idea of becoming corrupted here at the very end, which is also a kind of an interesting thing. If you are a human being, if you're living in this world, you are going to become corrupted. Does that feel bad or does it feel good? It feels bad, right? We don't want to be corrupted. We would rather be pure-hearted. I don't know about you, but I'd rather be pure-hearted than corrupted. But actually, it is not your choice. You are going to be corrupted if you have been born as a human being. Are you ready to be corrupted? Don't really want that, right? Corruption feels dodgy. But corruption here in Buddhism just means that your heart is being corrupted by all of these negative qualities of the mind. They are the qualities of greed and ill will and these kind of things. These are the corruptions. And unless we do something about this, unless we practice a path that counteracts these tendencies, they will have a tendency to grow inside of you. So if you want to overcome the corruptions within, and when you get corrupted, you become lower as a human being. Corruption has this feeling about that. You feel less worthy. You feel less self-esteem because you have all of these negative qualities inside. I don't know about how you feel about yourself when you have a lot of anger and greed and these kind of things. But the usual feeling is that you feel kind of, you don't feel good about yourself. But when your mind is very pure, when your mind is very bright, when you feel joy because of the Dhamma, it kind of lifts you up. You feel a sense of purity and it elevates you as a human being. So we want to avoid this kind of corruptions as well. I'll talk a bit more about this later on as we go through this. So these are the things that are bad qualities, right? All of these things are things that we would rather avoid. These are things that are called suffering in life. And when we are subject to all of these kind of sufferings, we go out and we seek other things that are subject to exactly the same thing. It's called an ignoble path because we are compounding the problem. We're making things worse. Instead of finding a solution to suffering in the world, we're making the suffering worse. So if you want to find a solution, we have to look somewhere else. This is really what the Buddha is saying here. So let us look at this in a little bit more detail, all of these kind of problems here. And what should be described as liable to be reborn? And the Buddha says, partners and children, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle are liable to be reborn. Yeah, so this is fairly obvious. So here you have the various kind of things that are liable to be reborn. Partners and children. Partners means like, you know, like your husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever. Partners. Yeah, they're going to die or they're going to be reborn down the track. Yeah, so they have still stuck in this samsaric existence. Children, same problem. Yeah, male and female bondservants. Bondservants is just a fancy term for slave, really. Or maybe not quite slave, but something similar to a slave. Goats and sheep. We have all of these animals coming up next. And, of course, animals, too, are part of the samsaric existence. They, too, will have to be reborn down the track, yeah? So all of these things are reborn. And you may wonder, why are these things spoken about? And the reason why these things are spoken about in this way is because all of these animals that are mentioned here, these are the things that were considered part of wealth in ancient India. If you were a wealthy person, you would have all of these kind of animals. Yeah, this is kind of how the ancient Indian society worked. And if you were asked about how wealthy you are, very often you would count your cattle. Yeah, the amount of cattle that you had would equate to how wealthy you were. So, for example, the Brahmins, they would have so and so many heads of cattle, and that would kind of equate to your wealth. This is kind of the idea of wealth. But this wealth you have is subject to being reborn. It is subject to samsaric existence. It will carry on in the same way, re-dying, re-being reborn, carrying on into the future in this way. So all of these things are then kind of subject to the same problem as you have, and so this is not the way out of the problem. It is compounding the same problem that we have already. This is the idea of being subject to rebirth. So I've talked quite a bit about the idea of rebirth already in terms of what it is like here, so I will just leave it at that for now. These attachments are liable to be reborn. So the Pali word for attachment here is upadaya. You see it down here. And upadaya means like things that you own, in a sense. And upadaya is a word that is used in the suttas to mean anything that you think you own. It can mean all of these living beings. It can also mean anything else in your life. It also includes like the five khandhas. In other words, the five things that make up a person. That's also a kind of upadaya, because we take this as being part of what we own in this world. So these attachments are liable to be reborn. And so we go out into the world and we attach to things. We buy into things, we hold on to them, and we try to keep them as ours, even though we know we can never hold on to these things. Why? Because they're liable to be reborn. They're liable to carry on. They're liable to kind of carry on through their own journey in samsara. So we're trying to hold on to things that are inherently unholdonable. And this is what we are seeing here. Is attachment liable to be reborn? Someone who is tied, infatuated, and attached to such things, themselves liable to be reborn, seeks what is also liable to be reborn. So you are tied, gattito, infatuated. Infatuated means like you are intoxicated almost, right? You are in love with, these things are dear to you. They go to your heart, right? They are important to you. And then ajapanno, here, attached to. So you have this kind of very close, profound, emotional relationship to these things. Like we all have, we have close emotional relationship to our partners, to our children, to many of the things that we own in this world. It's all about ownership. And the closer, the more attached you are to these things, it means that you are searching, or you are holding on to the things that actually lead to more problems in life. So there's a very kind of useful thought right there. Reminder that when we attach to all of these things in our life that are very powerful to us, that are very meaningful to us on a kind of ordinary level, actually, we are doing something that actually is problematic down the track. So one of the benefits then of the spiritual path is that gradually we are loosening some of these ties. Some of the infatuation, some of the attachments that we have, some of the problems that we find with these things, the ties are gradually being loosened. They're gradually being cut. And we are unchaining ourselves from this whole process of samsaric existence. And this is kind of the idea here. We are no longer buying into this idea of holding on to the things that are being reborn in the world. So that is the beginning of this idea of the ignoble search and the noble search for what is being reborn, and it's only really the first one. Usually when the Buddha talks about the noble search, what you may remember when you think about the suttas overall, the Buddha often talks about the divine messengers. This is kind of a very famous phrase in the suttas, the Devaduta. Devaduta are like the messengers coming from the heavenly realms, reminding us of the dangers of life. And usually the devadutas are things like, you know, sickness, old age, and death. These are the usual kind of devadutas. The fourth one then is the kind of ascetic sometimes, which reminds us of the alternative path. And usually the way that this is phrased, there's a well-known sutta in the Anguttara 3, it's called the Sukumala Sutta, which is about how the Buddha was brought up in great comfort, and then he saw and he reflected on old age, sickness, and death, and that is actually what made the Buddha go forth, according to that particular sutta. So these are like the main ideas that kind of made the Buddha go forth, yeah? Especially sickness, old age, and death. These are the three main things. Yeah, this is what you see again and again in the sutta, as in a number of places. But here we have the idea of rebirth, right? And the idea of rebirth is actually much more rare as part of this process. And it is really only found in this particular sutta. So it's important to remember what the main issues are. The main issues is not rebirth. And the reason why rebirth is not the main issue is because rebirth is, after all, in the realm of confidence, in the realm of faith. Yeah, you don't know about rebirth. You don't know if this is true. Of course, from the Buddha's point of view, it is true. But what we can relate to very directly, what is immediately meaningful to each one of us, are the ideas of sickness, old age, and death. These are things that we can know for sure, because we see them around us at all times. And so these are the most significant ideas. Why rebirth is added here? It is possible, I don't know this, it is possible that this have maybe been added later on. It may be a later addition. It could also be that it is added here just to expand on the basic ideas of old age, sickness, and death, right? Because this is limited in a certain way. So it could be an expansion on that. Or it is possibly also a later addition. It's very hard to really be sure what is going on. But probably it is more like an expansion to kind of bring out a broader idea. So remember, this is kind of an important distinction. The Buddha tends to focus on things that are immediate and tangible. And what is immediate and tangible are the things that we can observe in our own lives. And then sometimes he adds to that ideas that we have to take on board on faith and confidence to bring out a broader picture of things. The problem with just focusing on illness, old age, and death is that it's all limited to this life. But the idea of rebirth brings out this panoramic idea of existence. When we see existence in its much larger context, and when you see existence in a larger context, it also brings in an additional sense of meaning here. Yeah, it brings in the meaning of kind of this panoramic view, which actually, if you think about it in the right way, it actually gives an enhanced incentive to practice the spiritual path. And that is why it is also part of this thing that we call the noble path contra the ignoble path, understanding the idea of rebirth in this way. So focus on the things that are immediately obvious to you, and then those things that are not immediately obvious, try to gain some sort of understanding and confidence, make them real in your own life. And I will talk more about this later on, how to make these ideas real. And then I think we are kind of bringing together many different sides of this whole thing. And then hopefully it will give rise to some kind of nobleness in our practice of the spiritual path. All right, so I'm going to stop there for this morning. And I don't know, was I supposed to stop for questions now, Bobby, or is it too late now, isn't it? So
yeah.
I forgot the timetable already. I had to look at the timetable and see what's going on there. So sometimes you just kind of go on randomly. Okay, everyone, so that's it for this morning. So now we're going to, let's all have a nice lunch together. Please have a nice lunch. And then we'll meet back again at, 1 o'clock, Bobby? Is that right? Is it 1 o'clock, Bobby? Yeah? Okay. 1 o'clock. Okay, so we'll see you back again at 1 o'clock. Okay.